totally within the realm of this podcast, so you're totally within there. I just want to make sure I pronounce your last name. It's Jerry Bellick?
So it's funny because my family's pronounced it Bellich all my life, and then after looking into my family history, I believe that they've been pronouncing it incorrect. So I never know how to answer that question anymore because the original last name was B-J-E-L-O-J-A-C, which is Bielik.
Okay.
So it ends with a K, not a Ch. And they changed Bielik to B-E-L-I-C-H, which I assume is supposed to be Bellick.
Well, so
I'm in this quandary because like there's my past and there's my family and I don't know which is correct.
Oh my god, this has never happened in the history of podcast.
It shouldn't be this complicated.
No, I mean it's funny, we're not even recording, but we're not even starting the show proper, but I'm probably gonna tag this on in some fashion just because it's so freaking funny. I've never had that happen where I said, how do you pronounce your last name? And someone's given me the as it turns out, I really don't know, but apparently it's pronounced this
now,
way.
Yeah, and because I don't know what to say now, like, I'll end up just freezing up for a moment, like, while I think about what to say, and people are like, what exactly is the problem?
See, maybe what you should do is opposed to saying, when I say Jerry Bellick, is it pronounced Bellick? You say, actually it's pronounced, and then you say an entirely different last name, like Smith or Jones or whatever, and they look at you even stranger.
What I've been doing is, because the original is spelled B-J-E-L-O-J-A-C, I've just been going with Bajelojack.
That's even better. That's
I know.
That's even better to say pronounced like that, because it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Bajelojack.
It's like, how do you... Because the thing is, a good interviewer won't question you. They'll just take it as fact, but then they'll hear it again, hear you say it, look at the word, and go, how... Because they'll put them in the awkward space. They'll put them in the, but that's not how, but that's their last name. They know how to pronounce it, wouldn't they? But how do they get those words? Where do those sounds come from? Is that Russian? You know, they'll just go off in their own space and not figure out where to go. All right, well, I'm going to say Bajelojack then, because that sounds way more awesome. All right. Maybe I should say Jerry. Jerry B. How about that? 3, 2, 1. Welcome to a fine edition of my so-called 8-Bit Life. I'm your host, Roberto Vegas. Joining me today, creator of the Choose-A-Tron Deluxe Adventure Matrix, Jerry B.
Hello.
How's it going there, good sir?
I am doing well. How are you?
Doing good. Cannot complain. Now, Jerry, I should probably explain to how the heck I met this guy and kind of came about it. Last time I recently had Wiley Wiggins from the Fantastic Arcade side of people, and... obviously, this year there's a whole slew of crazy games and things I was looking forward to. Things like Crypto the Necro Dancer and a couple other cool things. There's one thing that caught my eye, and it was the craziest thing because of what it was named, and it was entitled the Choose-A-Tron Deluxe Adventure Matrix. And I was like, "What the hell is that thing?" And I read this description. This is exactly what I read verbatim from Fantastic Arcade's page. The Choose-A-Tron is a mini arcade kit that plays choose-your-own-adventure style stories. Narrative is printed out like a receipt, pausing for the player to make choices via 4 buttons. When the player gets to an ending, they can tear off the story to keep and compare with others. And I had to see that thing. Like, it was probably the coolest thing I'd ever heard of when I read it, and seeing it was probably the coolest thing ever.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was definitely cool. So I got to ask a couple... Well, because it's very unique. It's a very, you know, you get into there, and when we were there at the whole Fantastic Arcade, they had them all, like, I think you had 4 of them set up, right, if I'm not mistaken, 4 or 5, maybe?
Yeah.
And they're all plugged in. They're all these, like, little kind of plasticky, do you remember, like, I think it was, like, the G4 Cube, like, way back when with the Apple computer stuff? It was almost that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was almost, like, that kind of size, because they're all transparent acrylic, and you could see inside them and how they're... inner circuitry worked and things like that. It was really just kind of a very interesting kind of way of presenting a game. I do got to ask some questions. So before we kind of start talking about the machine itself proper and start talking about that, we got to kind of dive a little back in history, let's talk about the man behind the machine, if so to speak. How the heck did you get interested in interactive fiction in the first place? Like, where the hell did that whole thing start?
Well, when I was a kid in the 80s, like a lot of others, I had Choose Your Own Adventure books and a lot of kind of the knockoff brands with varying levels of quality. And so, like, I enjoyed reading them and going through them, but in all honesty, like, there were only a few that really stuck with me. A lot of them I was just very interested in the concept, but the writing was just very poor.
Yeah, no, go ahead, sir.
Oh, no, and because I was reading things like The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, so I was, you know, looking for more, and and like the promised adventure usually didn't quite kind of live up to a Tolkien or a Douglas Adams or
no, dear like Lord, that. No. It's funny when you mentioned that because I was thinking throughout this whole time like all of the Choose Your Own Adventure books that I have experienced. And I think the ones I remember like the most and only vividly, I remember they actually had a Mario Brothers 3 one where you actually kept track of coins and items and things like that.
Yeah.
And the only other one I remember was like this weird one where this kid's on a plane and something about a watermelon scene. Those are the only like vivid memories in my head because they're all like the thing is with the Choose Your Own Adventure book, for those who've never read one and for those who are kids who've never experienced this, essentially it's a book where you'll read and it'll have a story there and it'll then present you with a choice. Like, does Jimmy jump off the cliff or does Jimmy, you know, rappel off the cliff? And you go to page 142 or 150, depending on what you're...
And usually it's second person, right? So it's usually like, do you jump off the cliff?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. It's never Jimmy. It's always, do you jump off the cliff? Which you're like, well, I guess I would. And the thing is that you end up looking for that. And what happens is usually when you start reading the adventure, you'll get to a point where it's like, well, I'm sorry, you lost. Too bad, no good ending for you. And then you'll end up getting frustrated as a kid, start flipping through the book, find the good ending, the ending that you want to get, and try desperately to backtrack to get there. Like, did you ever do that as a kid?
Oh, yeah, cheating. Cheating was a big problem with the...
Well, because we all wanted the good adventure. We all wanted the good ending. We all wanted to find the adventure, because we all got stuck at that one point where it's like, what, we're back in the real world? How did I get back the plane? I thought I was doing so well. Like, we all wanted that good, you know, welcome to the Shire kind of ending, and we never got there. Do you remember your first Choose Your Own Adventure book, or is it just only the ones that are just vividly stuck in your head?
I do have kind of the two books that really stuck with me, and those books weren't actually Choose Your Own Adventures. They were they have the tagline "The choice is yours."
what a tagline!
So, you know, and they were one's called The Forbidden Towers, and one is called Adventure in the Lost World. And these were two that I felt like actually fulfilled at least a little bit of that promise of, like, I felt like I had choices that mattered. The story was, like, interesting and engaging and didn't feel like one storyline that just let me deviate here and there and then always forced me back into one place. The Forbidden Towers did it in an interesting way. It's all about, I think it's, like, five towers. Each one has kind of a theme. There's one that's the Tower of Spiders, the Tower of Bones, the Tower of Hands, and so on. And from the very beginning, you're trolloping through the woods and gathering berries, and you head back to your village, and one of your villagers comes out and is like, nope, stay away. We got the plague while you were out picking berries.
Okay. So, wow, that's a quick time to get the plague.
Right? It was bad. So they're like, if you could... You know that set of towers over that hill that we've always said never talk about, never look at, and never go to? Well, in the center happens to be the cure. Don't ask me why I know, but could you go get it? And so you go to this tower, and you have to pick which tower you're going to enter. And so the storyline can kind of intertwine, because even once you go in one tower, depending on the choices you make, you could end up in a different one. And so there are lots of weird ways to die, lots of, like, pseudo-logical choices you can make. I mean, it's still kind of, like, feels random in some areas, but a pretty solid adventure, and getting the cure and helping your people, all that kind of stuff.
Well, because that was always a thing about those books. It's just they always, when it came to the choices, I always felt sometimes that they, like, they would be right, that they're kind of pseudo-random. They never felt like I, the one thing I always hated about those books is that it never gave me a choice that I would always feel the character was supposed to make.
Yeah, yeah. And I totally agree with that. This one I don't think was as bad as most, which is why it always kind of stuck with me, and I always kind of went back to it. I'd gotten an old computer and started writing my own Choose Your Own Adventures in QBasic, just because I enjoyed the forum and I was trying to find ways to kind of be creative in that area myself. And then what I actually started doing was, when I was hanging out with friends, I would just start telling them a story, and we'd set it up where I would just explain what setting they were in, a little bit about each of them, and then they would just each take a turn telling me what they wanted to do in the story.
Oh, wow. Kind of like almost like a pre-D&D kind of thing, it sounds like.
Yeah, it really was. And I didn't know anything about Dungeons & Dragons, but it was very much that, like, game master thing. And we ended up doing this quite a bit, and there were never any pieces. There was never any pre-script or anything. I would just make up riddles and make up traps and make up songs and make up all this weird stuff off the top of my head, and they would kind of learn the rules of that world by, like, you know, seeing where they could push the limits, and then if anybody did anything I didn't like, I would punish them. So,
much like a good DM should.
Right. So I had a lot of fun because I was in control, and I got to, like, create the world and kind of dole it out. And they had a lot of fun kind of figuring out where that adventure would go and how to kind of play the story with me. And that was something that always kind of stuck with me, is that kind of style of dynamic storytelling. And it's something that I still kind of miss. The other place that I felt like I had kind of gotten that is I would play Mushes.
Oh, okay.
Online, text only. I think the acronym is multi-user.
Multi-user shared dungeon, yeah.
And MUDs. Although I actually would very quickly get bored with the MUDs because I only liked interacting and role playing with other real people.
Oh, interesting. So it was because this is where we kind of go back a bit now. Because I remember you mentioning QBasic. Like, how the heck did you get into the idea of doing software development? Was it just because, well, I want to do this interactive fiction stuff on some forum, and the books just aren't that accessible right now to write? Is that why you gravitate towards, like, things like QBasic and developing on software, that kind of stuff? Or is it just, you know, was it something else about tech that kind of brought you into it?
I mean, as far as kind of why I got into computers, it was at the age where having a home computer was a pretty new thing. And because of the work my dad was doing, he got a new computer, and it had this amber screen monitor and really, really old, a 2400 baud modem. And so I was, you know, fascinated by that when I was growing up. And I remember watching him play the original Wolfenstein. Not Wolfenstein 3D, but the one before that.
Oh, wow.
Which was just 2D, and you're running around all these rooms, and it had some voice synth, I think. And you're going through all these chests and trying to figure out a way out. And for some reason, the Nazis were constantly booby-trapping their own chests. That was a little weird since you're escaping from their place. But I would sit in the corner of his office and just watch him play games like that. So I was very intrigued by computers. And whenever there was a piece of electronics I was allowed to tear apart, I would. I loved circuit boards. I would set them up like they were little cities, like Legos, essentially.
Right.
And didn't know how they worked or anything like that, but just wanted to, like, dig into them. I remember once I was cracking open a television. It was like 2 a.m. I was supposed to be in bed like 4 hours prior. And I broke the tube.
Oh, no.
So the loudest noise ever. Shattering glass. Explosion. And I'm just sitting there in the aftermath, and the only thing that I can think of is, oh my God, I hope nobody heard that.
Break open a CRT, like that's the noise. That's like, you're not like, you're like, God, I'm so glad to be alive. You're like, shit, I hope no one heard that.
And my parents, thankfully, at that time were like a floor and a half below. So I waited for like the stomping of like my father's footsteps like coming up the stairs, and it never happened. And
wow.
So I quietly, carefully cleaned everything up, put it away, and I was like, huh, TVs explode.
That's what you took away from it. Like, I should never open TV again. TV explode. Not anything else. Like, I, you know, because imagine, because think if you look back on TV, here's a question. Knowing what you know now,
yeah,
are you surprised you're still alive when it comes to those sort of things? Because, like, opening a TV, I've always been told, is, like, the most dangerous thing to ever do.
Is that? Like, really?
Well, because apparently, like, there's, like, a giant capacitor in there that if you touch it the wrong way, that will just boof, and, like, you know, from what I've heard, I don't know, I've never opened a TV up, so I can't.
If we're going to be afraid of electricity, I don't think we'd be as far as we are right now.
I guess, but there's being cautious and being afraid. I guess this is where guys like you exist, because like whereas I would be like, I would never want to touch that. Like, I was always a software guy because I could control that a lot more and I could easily manipulate that. But when it came to hardware, I would just freeze the hell up because I could A, never solder, and B, I would always be afraid of like burning myself. I was always afraid of injury for some bizarre reason, and that was my biggest fear. Whereas like, it sounds like you were a bit more fearless in that. How did that then translate to like did that end up translating that to making stuff at that point, or like at what point in your cycle of making, you know, all this kind of programming and things like that did I go, you know, let me try to build something now? Like, when did that bug hit you finally?
Well, I mean, I was tearing stuff apart, blowing up televisions, evidently. And never learning anything from that. It never crossed my mind that that was a dangerous thing to do even after, because nothing bad happened. I was fine. So
it's like, well, nothing bad happened this time. I guess it's totally cool.
And I'm pretty sure I've at least shocked myself with an outlet a couple of times. So I'm not as scared as I probably should be of electricity. And I know lightning struck the cable box in the back of the house once. I don't know. It's just always been around. But
it's like, I don't know, the fear of electricity just doesn't register in my head. I've always known its existence, and that's about it, really.
Yeah, exactly. I've heard of it. So I would just take parts of stuff, and I would build robots. I actually, what I loved doing was taking circuits, little integrated circuits, hot gluing tails on them, and putting googly eyes on the front. I was obsessed with that. I made so many circuit bugs. Like, just because I was like, they're like little creatures. They have so many legs. And I still have them. I found this little box in my old stuff when I was going through the attic. And I still have all these little circuit bugs.
Oh, my God. That's actually kind of awesome. Because, I mean, that what's funny that you bring those up, I have seen people do that now. And like, you are right. They do kind of look bug-like in that kind of weird fashion. Because I remember, like, me as a kid, when I'd look at circuit boards and that kind of stuff, I would see cities. I would see these kind of weird futuristic cities in them, you know, because, like, the roads and everything else. I've later learned everything that's inside those things and kind of what makes them. But it's still kind of fascinating to see other things within there and how you kind of construct that. So did you ever like start go beyond the googly eye bugs, or is there a time or did you like, well, I have achieved the most I can achieve from these circuit boards, and I've created googly eyed keepsakes for, you know, to sell at the roadside or something?
I know it actually kind of makes me sad that I've seen those for sale, because I'm like, really, like, that's for weird small minds to come up with, not for sell. I basically went from, like, I played with the hardware as toys. I didn't really have a way to understand much more about the hardware, because we were kind of out of the decade where electronics were large enough and not as contained so that you could actually tinker with them and you could learn how to fix them, like old radios and stuff like that.
Right.
Once we got to integrated circuits and all of that, it just, it wasn't plausible, and there were no resources for it. Like, we didn't have Arduinos back then, so there's nobody to be like, hey, you seem really interested in this. Like, maybe you should actually learn something about it.
Yeah, we had, like, at the most, a crystal radio kit or some like, you know, build an LED-like thing. Nothing that fascinating. I was about the same way when I kept seeing, like, I don't really want to make a radio. Why would I? I can buy one of those or something.
Yeah, and my brother had one of those kits, like my older brother. He had the electronics, whatever kit. And so I would see him do stuff and, like, play around with it a bit. But the big, weird plastic kits, like, it didn't capture my imagination at all because it wasn't what, like, how it worked necessarily that drew me in. It was the aesthetic itself. It's the hardware. That was the toy. That was the cool part. The cities of circuits, the little bugs, like, because that's all the stuff I was creating. It was all these stories and all these, like, weird fantastical worlds. And we'd invent creatures all the time and all these really, really intricate backstories to it. So, like, as computers kept developing, like, I got my dad's old computer in my room. The hard drive crashed almost immediately, but I had Q modem on a 5 1/4 floppy. So I used it for years to dial into the mushes and to bulletin boards, like an old BBS bulletin board, Noodle Ranch. And so then it turned much more into that I was interested in games and kind of the game design and then ultimately the software behind it. But a lot of what I learned about computers and what kept me kind of very connected with them is I would mess with my dad's computer so much that ultimately I would do something to break it. And Windows wouldn't boot anymore, whether it was Windows 3.1 or Windows 95.
Okay, what is the... Every geek has this when it comes to tinkering stuff, that they've broken something that they wish they didn't break. What is the worst... especially when it comes to the parent's computer. Because I've encountered this too, and I'm trying to remember what mine was. Do you remember your biggest fuck up? Like the one where you...
I do.
Oh, God, yes.
I had done something, it was probably Windows 95 era, and I had done something where it could no longer boot anymore, couldn't figure out what was wrong with it, and I even called Microsoft.
Oh, no.
Look, you gotta help me. Like, my dad's gonna kill me. I have, like, an hour and a half to fix this, or I'm gonna be just flayed alive. And they did all the basic dumb stuff, and I was really irritated. Even then, I was like, really? Like, you are not helping.
Yeah, it's like, look, I've already tried all that. Can you kick me to someone else? What the fuck you're talking about?
Exactly. Like, let's go up the ladder here, people. So I gave up on them, and I honestly don't remember what happened or what I did, but I just kept fiddling with files and screwing around with stuff and somehow figured something out where I was able to, like, recover Windows and get it to at least start up again and, like, get far enough into booting where I could actually do some other things and get it going again. And it was like 5 minutes before my dad got back. I was sweating and terrified. Like, I was really, really fucking scared. And so he gets home and I just look like a complete wreck. And I was like, well, what's wrong with you? Nothing. I'm going to my room. Just completely just a mess.
I'm trying to think of mine, but the only thing that comes to mind for me was I was in high school. And that's when, like, my parents had got me a laptop, like a really nice Dell laptop. And I had it in my head because at that point Linux was starting to come about and things were starting to come out for that. And this is the only memory I have is that the next day I had a report due. I had like maybe a quarter of it done. And somehow in my mind, I said, you know what I need to do is put Linux on my laptop. And this is like the early days of Linux when, like, putting on a laptop was actually way trickier than it should have been.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember I spent hours just trying to get the sound to work. And for some reason, I got it to boot up, got a GUI, but I was like, no, I need sound as well. And I took, like, it goes on to the middle of the night, and I'm like, crap, I still got to write this goddamn paper. And I think I pretty much spent the entire night writing that, you know, once I got the system working to that. So I'm trying to think of, for me, Because I know I have, like, screwed up disk drives before. I have broken capacitors and things like that. Just hoping to God things work. So it's funny that you bring up that story because it does kind of inspire something in mind. But let's not go into the... Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah. I think most of what I learned under the, like, just out of the pure fear of God.
Or your parents killing you. Yeah. One of the two. Now let's get to the meat of the thing. Let's actually talk about this crazy, you know, clear acrylic box that I saw called the Choosatron Deluxe Adventure Matrix. Let's first explore, for those who have no idea, let's explain what this whole thing is, and then we're going to probably start asking some questions. Could you give a quick gist of what the hell this, for those who, if someone has never seen this box, and someone comes up to you and says, oh, what is this thing? This looks like a receipt printer. You would say?
It's a Choose Your Own Adventure arcade machine.
What the hell is that, good sir? I love this imaginary idea already of like, what the hell is this, good sir? Well, let me tell you.
Cheers, what ails ya? It'll make you walk.
I'm about to say, it sounds like a vaudevillian sort of thing.
You hit the first button you see, sir, and let it spit right out. it's basically a way to generate a linear story out of a myriad of possibilities by using a printer that's actually dynamically outputting the results of your story. So it's that middle ground between like a full-on computer game and a print book. Like, so you don't get to see all of the other possibilities. You just see the one that you went down, like life.
This is what was kind of interesting, and I was thinking when I was going back in my head about this whole entire thing, and especially in the time we are now, we're starting to see kind of a resurgence, especially in the indie side of things, of indie game development, of interactive fiction, you know, with things like Dear Esther or Gone Home, and even more so with the modern, you know, point-and-click adventure games, and even if you go back in time with Tex Adventures. I guess my question is, why go with hardware? Like, why pick the hardware option of things? Especially considering it sounds like you're more of a software guy kind of growing up, and sort of that's what, you know, a lot of the hardware sort of is more of you know, looking at the hardware not for the, ooh, what can I do with it? More like, ooh, what can I create out of that physical hardware that's different? What story can I tell around this hardware? Was it just because it left a little bit of mystery to the player, or was there something more to it than that?
It was really the way it kind of started was I've been doing software development for over 10 years now, and the last I've been working at an agency in Minneapolis for the last 3.5 years or so, and currently I'm their senior mobile developer. So I've been working on, you know, software for iPhones and Androids and tablets and all this stuff, and part of it was I'm getting just absolutely sick to death of bright screens and no like tactile feedback. I'm sick of touching glass.
Oh, interesting.
And like it just, I needed to do something interesting. I needed to feel something, not in the emotional sense,
but like actually touch something,
feel something. And we had done a big project for the Cosmopolitan Casino in Las Vegas, which was really fun, a big installation piece. And the other kind of company or group that we were working with outside of us, they play around a lot with hardware and Arduinos and all sorts of installation stuff. And when we were on a call, one of them had mentioned the Arduino. I was like, oh, yeah, I've been really interested in that. Like, I've heard a lot about it. It sounds really cool. I've wanted to learn more about hardware, but it's this really intimidating beast because you don't know what you don't know. And that's always like the hardest situation to be in for me when trying something new is it's okay if I don't know something. That doesn't stop me. But when I have no idea what I don't know and like feel this complete and utter ignorance, then I get really frozen because I don't like to get into something doing it the wrong way, because then I'm afraid I'm going to learn it the wrong way, and then somehow that's going to be burned into my mind as the only way I can ever do this.
And that's tricky with hardware, just because there's so many ways to approach hardware. I mean, you can, we're now in a in a time period where we can, well, you can code in C, you can code in assembly, you can code in every different way. There's different ways to do things. There's so many different options in terms of making hardware or even experimenting with hardware that a lot of it is kind of intimidating. So then what got you, was it just for the fact you kept hearing about the Arduino that's what gravitated towards you, or was there some, or were you like, well, it's not that hard actually. Like, what triggered the Arduino side of things? Just because you kept hearing about it or something
else? Well, he mailed one to me the next week.
Oh, okay.
So it showed up on my desk and I was like, oh, that was really cool of him. And so I put it in my drawer and I was like, all right, well, now I need to figure out what I'm going to do. And so I just started perusing, like, Adafruit, Spark Fun, like, whatever sites that just had that kind of big list of, here's all these sensors you can get, here's all these lights, here's all this other stuff. And trying to, like, because I always have so many projects and so many ideas in my head that it's not, like, trying to come up with a new one. It's just trying to find the right output that, like, fits that hole. And all of a sudden, like, a few of my ideas will be like, oh, we would work. And two of the ideas that had been in my head is I wanted to do something that was just about arcades, and that was kind of the other half of that coin is, like, I love that nostalgia of arcades and pumping quarters into stuff. And also to the Cosmopolitan thing, when I went out there to the casino, it was the second time I'd been to a casino in my life and the first time in many years. And I was so crestfallen when I realized you didn't get to put all the coins in and have the coins come out. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, that's right, yeah, because they're all, like, card-based now.
It's all digital. And I was like, they took the only thing I liked about this away. Like, casinos just are so weird to me, but, like, at least I could have fun clinking in the coins and that great sound of all the ching-ching-ching-ching-ching-ching.
I was going to say, yeah, like, that's, like, for me, like, I've never been to a casino, but it seems like the most unappealing thing ever because they're not even fun. Like, they're for me, and coming from the same era of you, when it comes to arcades, of playing, you know, Turtles, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the Simpsons Arcade,
yeah,
Galaga, and things like that.
Yeah.
Where I'll put in a quarter, but I'm actually, you know, though granted, yes, I suck at a lot of those games and I'm terrible at them, I still have a certain amount of control as to how the game is played and how things are. I'm able to move Pac-Man a certain way. If I memorize the patterns, I'm able to, you know, almost brute force my way through the entire game if I wanted to, and I have a chance to do that. Whereas in with casino games, just you pop in a coin and, you know, chance each time. And so it always seemed like not that fun of a thing, and I'd always have my, you know, see the adults, you know, talking about that. I'm like, how is that even fun? Why aren't you playing these games? These are, well, at least these are fun. You can control these guys.
Yeah. It reminded me of this game I'd played a long time prior called Progress Quest.
Okay.
I think that's what it was called, which is basically a role-playing game that plays itself because it automates all of the tedious things that, like, you have to do in a role-playing game. And so you don't actually play. You just hit start.
That doesn't seem fun at all.
It does everything else for you. And that's all I could think of is you basically, like, all you do now is press a button. You don't collect anything. You don't do anything. So they might as well just have it automatically keep playing by itself until you get up off the chair.
You just sit down. And it's like, lose, 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 win, lose, win, win, win.
Yeah.
Lose.
That was kind of the other half of it. And that along with kind of interactive fiction and choice-based fiction, I'd been looking for something to kind of explore those ideas. Because the first prototypes I made for the Choose-a-Tron all had coin acceptors.
Yeah, that was one thing that I think you had mentioned during your Fantastic Arcade, when you're talking about the whole machine, sort of the behind the scenes of it, that it had the coin acceptor as sort of a, you know, to kind of have that arcadey feel to it. I forgot why it was. You just took it away because it made no sense after a certain period of time? Because I can't remember exactly what you had said during the whole...
It made dollars. The problem was because I was going the route of the Kickstarter and funding and, like, trying to produce and manufacture a large number of them, the coin acceptor is not a cheap component. So it added a lot to the price. It made the size of the Choose-a-Tron significantly bigger.
Right.
Even the ones I had out in Austin for Fantastic Arcade, those are even bigger than the final model's going to be.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Because those are pretty small. I mean, they weren't bulky. You know, they didn't seem bulky. They seemed like a pretty good size.
They're not huge, but there's still a kind of a lot of open space in them.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of air in there.
So that was part of it. Is I just had to make that decision because in the end, the people that were buying them, not all of them would want that. Like, you don't. Some people want an arcade machine in their house. Some people want a Nintendo or a console.
Right.
You don't put a coin acceptor on every Nintendo, even if they get to keep the money, because that's just really annoying.
Yeah, that's why. You put on a Play 10, the arcade machine version out there, as opposed to that.
So basically, I deferred that. It's not gone. And as part of the Kickstarter, we got to a stretch where we basically promised that we would put in the time and energy to design a mod kit that we can sell, that you could turn your Choose-a-Tron into an actual arcade machine.
Because I think that's still an interesting concept for that. Like, the idea of taking a quarter to experience this interactive story. I gotta ask, what was the hardest part during, like, developing this thing?
So once I knew what I wanted to do, I went on Adafruit. I ordered all the parts at once.
Right.
And basically, I just started taking, you know, the code samples they had, and attaching each component one by one, and making sure I understood how that piece worked. So only working with a keypad, only working with the coin acceptor, only working with the printer, and so on, until I could just, at least I had a concept of how all those work. The benefit for me is I've done plenty of C and C++ coding, so the software side of it wasn't holding me up at all. The scary part was, like, I was realizing just how little I understood about electricity, and it was almost kind of embarrassing. Like, you know, all the type of work I do, and I just didn't even understand some of the most basic elements of electricity, and, like, voltage versus amperage, and wattage, like, and what these things mean, because I just have not been confronted with it. It hasn't mattered because everything is taken care of for you.
Right. You've been on the software side of things so much, or the last time you've ever looked inside of a, you know, a device, it was, look at all these cities in these little circuits here.
Exactly. So it just, that was a tricky part. It took me about a month and a half to get the first prototype fully working and, like, built, and the software worked, and I could actually, like, carry it in my hands and it wouldn't fall apart. And so that was incredibly satisfying. It was like a breadboard with an Arduino and all these wires taped inside of a box, but it was something. And I was having a lot of fun with it, because then that's when I had found Twine and basically wrote some Python scripts of my own to convert its source code into this really, really low-level format that the Choose-a-Tron could read.
Okay.
The big problem is that the Arduino, it uses an Atmega 328 chip, which is 2 kilobytes of RAM.
So wow.
There's so little, and I didn't want to limit the writers. So it was this very, like, clever buffering to make it so the story could be as long as a writer wanted it to be, but still able to run through it. But
yeah, how is that, like... sorry, go ahead, sir. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, that's okay. But it did, like, start limiting all of the other stuff I wanted to do. Because, like, I've wanted to add variables. I've wanted to add, like, randomization. And, like, all these other features where you can then blur that line even further of, is it just choice-based fiction? Is it a game? Like... And kind of like you were saying, with some of the old books, they had like pen and paper methods where you keep track of stats. And there's Tin Man Games now with their game adventure books, like their digital ones, that basically do that for you, but are like one big part choice-based fiction and then one big part character sheet and inventory and other little things like that.
And what's interesting about hardware, and this is why I find it fascinating when it comes to developing it, not the pitfalls you necessarily had going into it, but the ones you kind of discovered. Did it ever at one point occur to you that maybe I'd picked the wrong chip, maybe I'd backed the wrong thing, and that you almost scrapped everything? Or was it that you had gotten so far already with this, specifically the Arduino chip and how much memory it had? Because this is where you always hit a weird barrier within hardware, that you have very, you know, especially when you're talking about a lot of these kits, they come with a very limited amount of memory. Not saying it's cool when you're doing, you know, something simple and something interesting like turning a light off or, you know, reacting to a sensor or something like that. But when it comes to, you know, the idea of, well, now I'm making a game, or I'm making something that people are going to interact with that's going to have a lot of memory. Like, did you ever hit a point where you almost got fed up with a chip and you're like, well, I've gone too far. I have to continue with this. Or like, was there ever that moment of doubt almost, especially because you've kickstarted this whole thing and now it's been funded, that you almost regret going with that chip?
Well, there was one point where I thought, boy, what if I just had it where it was essentially a dummy terminal and there was a computer running it? Like, because that would be easy, right? Like,
right.
If you had this box with buttons and a printer and something else, like whether it's maybe it's across Ethernet or whatever, but something else is making all the decisions, doing all the logic, and then just sending a bunch of bytes to print out.
Right.
Like, it would have been so simple. And I thought about that at one point, and then I immediately, like, almost shied myself. I was like, you coward.
It's like, well, like, you're just giving up on this?
It's like, you could get it to work, but you know you would be a failure. And I've never shied away from things like that. Like, I do so many weird different things that that's how I like learning something new, is like throwing myself into the fire and seeing if I can, you know, get through it. Whether it's like building puppets or like reading a movie or, you know, whatever. A lot of stuff I've done in my career is people have come to me because they're like, oh, I hear you do a lot of different things. Like, could I pay you to do this? And I never have done it before, but I'd say, sure. And then I would have a really, really stressful period of time where I'm trying to brute force learn something. And I would find some way to get through it and to make something work. And it like just got to a point where I was like, I never doubt that I can figure something out. It just might not be the way I expect it to be. But one way or another, I will conquer.
You're not going to back away from a challenge just because simply that a roadblock comes up. You're going to figure out a way to either jump over that roadblock, go around it, destroy it, do whatever you have to get beyond it. I got to ask you a random question.
Horizon.
I got to ask a random question because you brought it up right now, and it was funny when I was doing – I usually will research people and figure out what I'm going to talk about and how I'm going to do all that kind of thing. And you brought it up already, and I have to ask this because I was reading your – I think it was on your on Clockwork site. I guess that's your – it mentioned that you tweeted, you know, that you were in Sweden. And you mentioned it right now, and I don't have to ask the question. I was like, you mean like in Be Kind Rewind, Sweden? And like, nope, you've already answered that question entirely. What is the craziest movie you've ever made in Sweden? For those who have no idea what Sweden is, go check out the movie Be Kind Rewind. That's the easiest way to explain it. It's essentially remaking a movie in like the weirdest way possible. I don't know how to explain it.
Low budget and kind of the... We came up with kind of a tenets of Sweden. Like, the idea is that you're always having fun. And
right.
by not allowing yourself to just, like, pay money to get through problems, like, and just other stuff. It's just, what do you remember about these movies that you love? How do you, like, express the movie? And taking what you have lying around, doing it in a weekend. The craziest movie is one that we haven't posted online yet. It's been in development for an embarrassing amount of time, but it's kind of true to itself in that fashion. We did David Lynch's Dune.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
It has followed the original in its chaos, in its absurdity, in its complete like inability to get done when it was supposed to be done. All principal photography was done in a weekend. And then all the effects stuff, like, that got crazy, and then the songs being done for it, it just got so out of hand. And I actually, at Fantastic Fest, I, the part, the closing party.
Right.
On the bus ride back, I showed, it was on my laptop, and I think Adam Saltzman brought up Dune for some reason. Or he brought up the Baron Harkonnen. I was like,
yeah, I was about to say, it was like,
hey, funny you mentioned the Baron Harkonnen. I got something you might want to see.
Oh my
and
God.
So I showed Adam and the Starwall guys and a couple other people a little over half of the Dune squeeze.
Oh my God.
And we ran out of time. We got back to the theater, but it was pretty interesting reaction.
Well, that sounds epic. Because Dune, especially that version of Dune, like that version of Dune is very much an '80s movie. Like there's no other way. Like Sting's in it, and there is music. Like there is a rock album opera. Like it gets very weird, very fast, in a good way.
Ours ended up being 13 minutes long.
Wow.
And it's huge. We've basically, what we've talked about doing is doing a speed cut of it that like trims it to only like the best, funniest, punchiest moments. And then having that extended cut and, seeing what happens. We spent so much time on it that we actually considered doing a Kickstarter to pay for throwing a party for the people that were involved.
Oh my God, that would be awesome. Because like, I'm just trying to imagine like Mahadev and everything that could happen in that Sweden movie now in my head.
My name is a killing word.
The weirding ways and all the, oh God, there's so much of that film that I would love to see how you guys sweet it. Like how you do the shields, I'm curious now.
Oh, the shields are the best part. Kyle also he did Fjord at Fantastic Arcade.
Right.
We closed the bar one of the nights, and he's showing me a bunch of his stuff. I was showing him a bunch of mine, and he watched the whole thing, and he's like, "The shields." I love the shields.
I'm gonna have to check this out when it comes out for sure. Now.
Yeah, we've been waiting for months and months for the credit song to get done. I finally, a couple weeks ago, I emailed my friend and I was like, look, because they already did they wrote it.
Right.
And they just needed to record it. And I was like, look, you need to tell me right now. Can you get this on the schedule and record it within the next few weeks? If not, then Melissa, who's works with me on a lot of projects like the Sweeting, we're going to get together over the weekend and we're going to just record the song ourselves somehow. So then he's like, okay, it's on the schedule. It's happening. So it's like any day it's going to happen.
Oh my God. All right. But,
the Sweeting stuff was weird. The first one I did off the cuff was the Hobbit Swede. And that like got really big. And then with the guy that wrote the screenplay for Sinister, he and I did a Swede of Die Hard. Which,
oh my God, I don't even, what's so funny is that you as a person, it's no wonder that when it came to Choosetron, you just said, F it, I'm going to do it the way I'm going to do it. Just hearing you talk about Sweeting alone, because like that is a challenge in and of itself, is how do you do this movie in a weekend, even though yes, it's funny, and though yes, it's lighthearted, and you're doing what's around you, you still have to, you know, shoot it and schedule it and figure out how you're going to do these things on the fly, and it's a testament now to understand you talking about this to kind of see how that same energy translates over to other kinds of things, especially things you're not super familiar with at the get-go. Hardware wasn't your thing, but getting there. God, this has been such an amazing thing. We're almost out of time. We still got a little bit of time left. But
sheer force of will. That's what it is.
That's the only way I can. I do got to ask a couple more questions, especially on the Choosers Run before we do bow out here. How is the Maker crowd taking to the whole thing? Like the actual guys that tend to tinker with things and build with it. Have they gravitated more towards it, or have more writers and creative others that who are not familiar with software or hardware development have gravitated more towards the device?
Surprisingly, the makers have all been super supportive of it and absolutely loved it. But it's actually the writers and the non-technical people that have completely like glommed onto it and been the major supporters. I had to shift the entire focus of the Kickstarter once, like, as I realized, like, I'm not doing this for the right group of people. Because originally I had this weird idea in my head, like, I'd offer all these different versions, like, you get the circuit board that's not put together because soldering is fun.
Yeah.
Which is a big, you know, line of bullshit. Nobody likes to solder.
No, soldering is bullshit. Soldering is the
hard. Never make someone solder. It's not cool.
Nope.
And so I had all these levels, and then I realized, but it's not for the maker. If anything, it's to get, like, kids and people, like, intrigued by, like, how things work. In the same way that I tore stuff apart, it didn't teach me how it worked, but it made me interested in how things work. And, like, with things today, with, like, iPads and everything, nobody's ripping those things open because their parents would kill them. And they're not getting exposed to any of that stuff. So, we're going to have this weird, like, glut of people interested in engineering and software and that creative aspect if we don't encourage that. But which is why the maker movement is so awesome.
Oh, yeah, totally.
It definitely became much more about getting people hooked and engaged with reading and playing it, which made them immediately want to write and create their own games, especially kids. And, like, going from there to teaching and all sorts of other kind of weird applications that I wouldn't have necessarily thought of. And the other thing I realized was, especially for teaching, it actually kind of short circuits a problem that we have now when it comes to, like, what if you want to make interesting, interactive, like, lessons, like you want to take people to Rome or to Pompeii or whatever, like, you're not going to be able to make a 3D adventure where you get to, like, explore all this stuff because nobody has the budget for it. And it's not going to happen.
Right.
But reading and storytelling and, using, like, the kids' imaginations, which are far more potent than any of the Xbox games they're playing or anything else. Like, if, like, you can write something well and you can design a story like that well, it's going to be far more interesting and far more engaging and allow them to explore stuff where they get to be a part of it and they get to have choices and not just, like, be sitting back and, like, letting everything roll over them. Because
right.
They have to be a part of it and they want to be a part of it.
Right, because we always say, I mean, games are, you know, especially a lot of video games are interactive, but you are right in terms of you get this visual already. You get whatever the creator wants you to see and wants you to believe, whereas within books, a lot of stuff is, you know, within your own head, within your own imagination. Whenever you read a Tolkien novel, when you read, like, Lord of the Rings, your mind is transported to this world. Not that it's, oh, it's in front of me and I'm looking at, you know, the, you know, how the movies looks. It's sort of, you get put in there. And I that's one thing I dug about the whole concept of Choose-a-Tron was that it was text, that it was the sort of story being told, and so you could see the length of how long it went. Because it was on this receipt. It was almost like, you know, unrolling a tome each time you looked at your choices and stuff like that. And everybody, I guarantee everybody there at Fantastic Arcade, at least once or twice, went like, what the hell is this thing? And it was like, it's a Choose-a-Tron, Deluxe Adventure Matrix. And you're like, it's essentially a Choose-Your-Own-Adventure game on text. And everyone played it. Everybody played it. You know, I played it like a couple times, if not three or four times. Because how many receipts did we have at the end? Like, we essentially had enough where we could just toss them around and throw them around.
Oh, yeah. The table was just covered with it. It was really a beautiful sight.
It was. It was so, so awesome. So since we're coming to the end, I got to ask, what is the future for this whole thing? Like, when is this, A, coming out, if a date's been put on there? And, B, what does the future hold for this whole thing? You and you, Jerry, the Choose-a-Tron, hardware, even now Sweeting, it sounds like. Like, is there – what – if you were to sum up, especially when it comes to Choose-a-Tron, the idea of it, what do you hope and dream that when this thing, you know, becomes real and everybody has in their hands, beyond just, you know, the prototype units you've made, what do you hope happens? Like, where do you see the product going or the idea of it?
My hope is essentially taking a lot of the like niche communities that I found online for choice-based fiction, interactive fiction, and just storytelling and kind of that literary creative writing aspect of it and making better tools and making them more accessible and making more interesting ways to engage with them. So it's like, I very much want to build a very easy to use tool for writing these kinds of stories and sharing them with people and not closing that off, everything being open sourced and out there. And there's examples of good kind of ways to write that type of stuff. Like the Inkle Studios has an online writing application, but like going even beyond that where, you know, you'll be able to send these stories to your Choosatron, you can share them with each other, see the data, like how are people playing your stories? Like if you could see how every person that's played your story did it the first time through, what would that tell you about your story and the information that you fed to the user, and why did everybody go this way and not that way, and learn about kind of how people make those decisions and learn about the game design and the mechanics behind that. And even with the hardware, it's, I mean, we're already, is one of the stretches we are working with Kobolds Ate My Baby. They, group that made this game, Ninth Level, made it, and having, replacing the firmware to be a tabletop assistant for that game. So it's printing out randomized character cards and event cards, and then taking that a step further and creating, you know, new games that have that digital backend, but then that physical aesthetic. But like for the Choosatron, it's for me, it's mostly about the storytelling and seeing what people can do with that medium today. Now that there's a lot more people that I can get in front of and a lot more people to kind of pick their brains and see what they can come up with instead of just like a few people that are writing all of the stuff, which, you know, can be good, can be kind of bad, and not doing everything in that traditional way. Because even the stories I've gotten from the authors so far are really, really, really different from each other. And some of them just completely surprised me in like how they decided to use that form for storytelling. For hardware, like, and that's something I want to continue. I've been working on prototypes for kind of another system that basically involves like storytelling in live spaces. And it's basically a philosophy that I've kind of developed with all of this is getting people to look up again. Like as a mobile developer, as somebody that's like been a part of this revolution of smart devices, I don't want to like go backwards and take away these great tools that we have, but I want to bring back that interesting information and those types of interactions to the real spaces and the real world, so that we're not constantly walling ourselves off from each other, but actually like in the same space as each other, we still all have these smart tools, but it's not the only point of focus and not the only thing that we're absorbed in. And that can be done through games and storytelling and even just like new novel ways of displaying information and how we interact with the spaces around us. So that's kind of the future that I'm heading towards, and the Choosatron, I think, is working out as a really great first step, and hopefully, like, I can kind of figure out that business side of it enough where I can actually keep putting my time into the creative end and see kind of where I can go with it. But, yeah, I'm excited to just figure out, how to support that end for myself, because, like, I mean, with a hardware project, the cost scaled very closely with the orders that came in. So I got enough money to like do some extra design work and funding on it, and working on the software stuff. But it's not like I'm going to make any money,
right? I mean, it's a first thing. But what I love about the Choosatron, and this is sort of the final thing I want to say on it, is that it puts in that same feeling of wonder that I had as a kid when I looked at the Nintendo and wondered how the hell that thing works. And that's a very weird thing to say, because I don't have that with my cell phone anymore. I don't have that with my iPad. I don't even have a computer because I know all this stuff. But when I was a kid, like the thing that spurred me to even look into how games are developed and how, you know, programming works was just simply from playing Nintendo games and going like, how the hell do they do this? How the hell do they do that? How does this box, you know, put Mario on the screen? And the Choose-a-tron does the same kind of thing. I mean, in the idea that when you hit a button and things happen, and it's like, well, how the heck is it all doing this? And it puts, especially when you have the story in front of you that you're reading, it puts that sort of, it transported me back to that sort of era of reading those sort of interactive stories, but not even so much that, but just my first kind of early days of gaming. And it's one of those the coolest things I saw there that I didn't know, that I thought I would like, oh, that seems cool, I'm definitely going to check it out, would then become probably my favorite thing of the entire conference. As much as I love certain games I played, as much as I got to talk to certain people, the Choose-a-tron probably was the coolest thing I saw during that entire Fantastic Arcade, just because of it being just that ingenious way of like, I have my story with me. It's tactile, it's physical. I can show it and compare it. And it was a very cool physical thing that I had not seen in gaming in a while. And definitely, Jerry, I think it's a great idea. And I can't wait till I can grab my hands on one of these things.
Then the two-player games are going to blow your mind.
Oh, my God. Don't tell me these things, Jerry. Do not tell me that there's two-player options. Don't tell me there's co-op in this thing or anything like that. Jerry, thank you so much for being on this show. Tell me where they can find you online and how they can find out more about the Choose-a-tron. And more importantly, how the hell can we watch your Swedes?
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter at Choose-a-tron. And there's no E in the choose, just Choostron. Choose-a-tron.com. And we're still taking pre-orders right now at shop.choose-a-tron.com. For the Swedes, let's see. Yeah, I think if you just search YouTube for Hobbit Swede under Monkey Theater as the user and Die Hard, and we'll get the Dune one up pretty soon.
I've got to see this one. I've got to see the Dune one.
Twitter is the best way to do it, or at least to find me or whatever.
There you go. Just find Jerry on Twitter. Of course, you can find me. I'm at Vincent404 there on the Twitters. If you want to talk about this episode, comment how you love the idea of the Choose-a-tron, how you want one so badly, go to our website, cosmogo.tv/8bitlife. There you'll find links to the show notes, previous episodes, all the social pages, and of course, other shows on this network of mine, including my gaming show, Jump Point. Set the show for today. Tune next week. We'll talk to another geek about something completely and utterly random. Bye, people.